Fourth case, United States v. Mehud. Mr. Ruth?
May it please the Court, my name is Robert Ruth, and I represent the defendant appellant, Randy Mehud, in this case. This is a direct appeal from a sentence in the district court. The principal issue in this case is whether the government proved that Mehud's three prior convictions amount to armed career criminal offenses, and to a lesser extent, whether the government even needed to prove it. We have three prior offenses. Two of them are from 1989. And all of the documents that were obtained by the parties in this case describe the particular offenses of conviction differently.
But let me ask you, are you contesting that he actually was convicted on these two offenses?
No. He was convicted.
So you agree that he was convicted. And you don't like the way the Illinois courts recorded the conviction on their order of sentence and commitment.
Well, I don't like it or dislike it. I note that it's not, it is a statute that doesn't exist under Illinois law.
I mean, one has to read these things with a certain amount of common sense. Can't you discern from this? I mean, whether it's a capital B or whether it's a small B or whether they put the subsection in, you know, the paragraph 401 part. You can see, I don't know why this isn't something where the federal court takes the evidence and finds it either sufficient or not sufficient to show the conviction. And if you wanted the Illinois court to show that that wasn't really the offense, wouldn't you have to go back to them?
Well, I think that if you're talking about hair-splitting differences, there's an argument to be made. Although, in Shepard, the Supreme Court said that it's not for the district court to make findings about the lower court.
Well, not the underlying substantive conduct, not what the person did.
No, if there is some ambiguity or something that's imprecise, that should be taken care of in the Illinois court. And the district court is just reading off what does it say, what does the Illinois court say? That's what we have to follow. We don't get to say, make changes and say, well, this is what they must have meant. But Your Honor,
what could they possibly have meant? They've described the manufacturing distributing offense.
But they don't. They call it
MAN/DIS.
Well, manufacturing delivery of what?
Well,
yes, it does. It does matter. But actually, though, let's get back to the question, because manufactured delivery of a counterfeit substance wouldn't count. Manufacturing and delivery of other substances may not have the appropriate statutory maximum. But let's go back to this question of hair splitting. We're not hair splitting here. We're talking about the wrong section. The offense that the PSR, now, so the judgment and the indictment, they're a little bit different as far as capital B, small b, parentheses on the B2, okay. Maybe that's hair splitting. But they have the section wrong, and they don't list the paragraph. They say chapter 56 and a half, section 1401, and then B2. However, it's said differently each time. But we'll just say
B2.
But
I'm looking at it, which you very helpfully, and I appreciate it, put in the back of the brief. There's 1401, and then there's this paragraph that does say section 401, but there's just nowhere else you could go.
No, it's chapter 56 and a half, paragraph 1401, section 401.
But there's no, it's not like there are five subsections under 1401. It's just the A through A, B, that's all it is. And then A and B have, it actually goes all the way up to G, but I just can't find I can't find the ambiguity that you're focusing on.
It isn't so much a question of ambiguity. It's a question of it cites a statute that doesn't exist. There is no section
1401. You knew which statute to put in here.
Pardon?
I mean, it's a careless citation. That I'll agree
with
you.
Well, except, Your Honor, when you're talking about a statutory citation, the details are everything. And we're not talking about a missing period.
But there's no other statute that you think this could have been. It's clear it's a 5-year sentence, right?
But it's not for me to decide. It's not for the district court to decide what else it could have been. The question is, do we have – it's very precise under the law what the court is supposed to do. You have specific documents you get to look at, like the judgment or the indictment. And you look at those specific documents and you say, does this amount – to a crime of violence or a violent felony.
Or controlled substance.
Or controlled substance offense. Okay.
To be, yeah.
And that's it. You don't get to say, oh, well, that statute doesn't exist, but they probably meant this, or they must have meant this.
But the statute does exist. 1401 is right there, and if you go down to the first B you find, you're at the right place.
Actually, 1401 doesn't exist. It's paragraph 1401, section 401. The pre-sentence in the district court said that it was, and the indictment says section 1401. Section 1401 doesn't exist.
Okay.
And so all we can do is say, well, this is what they must have meant. But you don't get to do that. And if this is what we must have meant, it would have been easy for the government to bring a sentencing transcript, a plea hearing transcript, some other evidence to show that this is what we meant.
But why wasn't this enough to shift the burden to Mr. Mayhurg to say, I was never convicted of a cocaine offense?
If citing a statute that doesn't exist is not enough to shift the burden, then nothing is enough.
It's a crummy citation. The statute does exist. It's right there in the paper.
Well, and you know, so we have a citation. We don't know what he was. He doesn't know what he was convicted of. He doesn't know the specific subsection. And so is it our job then to go hustle the transcript and prove a negative? It's the government's job to prove it. And quite frankly, I'm not even sure we get to the point of burden shifting, Your Honor, because the question is the pre-sentence report accurate and reliable? Okay? And so they don't even tell us, they don't even acknowledge this discrepancy. I'm the guy waving his arms and jumping up and down saying, this doesn't exist. And the first it was acknowledged was by the government in a footnote to say, well, this is what they must have meant. You don't get to do that under the Sixth Amendment. Assume what they must have meant.
If we had a remand situation, what would you suggest the government could do?
Well, I don't think on remand they get to reprove it. They're stuck with what they did at the initial sentencing. And when you don't prove it at the initial sentencing, that's the end.
Do you want to just take a moment on stalking the issue?
I would like to. The bottom line on stalking is we've got two cases. We've got Billups and Kapler, okay? And Billups was a Wisconsin false imprisonment case, and it has a specific non-consent element. And Kapler is unlawful restraint. It's Illinois. And the courts have said it has a non-consent element. There's the hang-up, because aggravated stalking in Illinois does not have a non-consent element. And these facts...
What about the residual clause? So the government seems happy to put all its eggs in that basket. Significant risk of physical harm, knowingly
right.
Without justification, place a person in apprehension of bodily harm, etc.
And that's where the non-consent element comes in. The idea is that if a person is restrained or confined without consent, it creates this dangerous situation. But if there is no non-consent element, if the person is, say, confined with consent, there is no dangerous situation. The aggravated stalking statute in Illinois, a person is guilty of that statute under the following circumstance. If a creepy man repeatedly follows a woman to her car, opens the door, she gets in, and he closed the door. That's aggravated stalking in Illinois, if it happens on two occasions, and if she reasonably apprehends these concerns that the statute calls for. Well, opening a door for someone and closing it behind them, that's confinement. That's, you know, but it's not. There's nothing malicious about it. There's the intent of the person who opens and closes the door is not an issue under the aggravated stalking statute. There's not even an issue of non-consent. So that's Illinois' aggravated stalking. That's not inherently a violent offense. Thank you.
Thank you, Spodaro. It's good to see that the U.S. Attorney still finds time to come to court.
Since I am the U.S. Attorney, I can do whatever I want, so I still take cases. For the record, I am John Vaudry. I am the U.S. Attorney up in Madison, and I represent the United States below as well. On the issue of these serious drug offenses, somewhere in law school, it said somewhere the law should not be a fool, and I can't remember where or why or how. But this is how this strikes me. What we're talking about is some Illinois Cook County clerk who has a gazillion cases a day writes down 56.5, okay, not 56 and a half, like the statute says, and section 1401, and then large B, paren 2. That's, I think, both women, his or her shorthand. And then the idea is that that's an unreliable document because, as Mr. Ruth has persisted in saying, it's an offense that doesn't exist. And I continue to say, as we said in our brief, that's just absurd. It doesn't say Chapter 58. It doesn't say Section 2000, as you pointed out in your questions, Judge Wood. You would go, the public defender who represented Mr. Maher obviously went to that statute, saw that he was charged with that crime. I do think, if it is at all up in the air, as this court said in Black from my office as well, then Mr. Maher can do something. And it isn't just, maybe he's got documents, but all he's got to say is, I never sold cocaine or I sold less than a gram. Because sub B covers controlled substances, it covers counterfeit substances, and it covers analogs. But it all has to do with amounts. And sub C of chapter 56 and a half, so on and so forth, just starts saying without amounts, but still a narcotic drug. And then D, which makes it a Class 3 felony, says other amounts than B, but not a narcotic drug. So what we've got here, in the charging document, it says 1 to 15 grams of cocaine. And it cites in pretty much the same, apparently, shorthand, the
is
same
statute.
Is
this page 2 with no identifying marks on it? I was a little worried about that. Where the actual substance is mentioned that the government supplemented with?
I'm not quite sure which page we're talking about.
Well, Mr. Ruth argued that the government came forward with, I'm looking, say, at Appendix 13, which is an attachment that shows that he's charged with more than one, but not 15, just what you said,
right.
Grams. But was that authenticated as part of this whole thing?
Authenticated, well, not in the sense that there was an affidavit from the clerk. I mean, that was submitted to the district court. The district court got really sort of if it's a grand jury cover sheet, but a cover sheet,
right.
And then got the charging document, which I think you're referring to, that says 1 to 15.
And then, that it was cocaine.
And that it was cocaine. And then the judgment. Now, the judgment doesn't actually, the judgment and commitment order doesn't actually refer to the drug. It
right.
just says M/DM, I believe.
Right.
But the charging document says 1 to 15 of cocaine, and then the statute, the judgment just refers back to that statute. So I guess I just think, Mr. Maher could have said, you know, I shouldn't have served 4 years, I should have moved to vacate. I think your questions alluded to that. If his public defender thinks, wait a minute, my guy didn't do 1 to 15 grams of cocaine, they've just given him 4 years in prison, well then, gee whiz, don't serve 4 years in prison. Go back and do that. Now, had he been under a different subsection, perhaps he could have got the same sentence. I realize that. But this is the only one. Sub B, under Illinois law, is the only one at that time that covered had the more than 10 years for our purposes. So I think, without spending any more time on it, it's our position, as I said in the brief, that there's really no other way to read this. It isn't some other book. It isn't some other chapter or subsection. It has all the right numbers with a few different parens, and one's capitalized and one's not. But I don't think it means he wasn't convicted of this serious drug offense because the Cook County clerk uses a quick shorthand to do that. And I don't think it involves any sort of due process or rule of lenity or anything. It just, logic just says that.
So what about the stalking?
Yes. Moving on to the stalking. I think, for me at least, it's important just to frame what we're talking about. In the residual clause, when one looks at Wallace, Billups, and Kapler, and Sykes from the Supreme Court, as ordinarily committed, does this crime, aggravated stalking, present that risk of a serious potential risk of injury? That fits it under the residual clause of 924. And I think Mr. Roos' argument comes down to, in his reply brief in today, that you could confine somebody with their consent and, like, you know, shut the door, we're going for a ride, there's no risk of anything. I think there's two problems with that argument. One is, and Wallace and Billups and Kapler say it several times, we're not looking for some hypothetical, non-confrontational way that this could be committed. We're looking for how is this thing usually committed. That's one thing. So there probably are scenarios that might be non-confrontational, but I'll return to that. The second point is when we look at the elements, knowingly, here's what you have to do to stalk, knowingly and without lawful justification. The same words in the Illinois unlawful restraint. I think it's knowingly and without lawful authority, but pretty much the same. Knowingly and without lawful justification, at least twice, you follow a person or place them under surveillance. And you place that person in reasonable apprehension of immediate or future bodily harm. That's stalking. Then to do aggravated stalking, you have to confine or restrain them. So knowingly and without lawful justification, all those elements, including confining or restraining. So I would...
Well, how important is the apprehension of bodily harm?
Well, I think it's important in this way, Judge Wooden, that's just where I was about to turn. I think in the scenario Mr. Wood is... I've just elevated him. Mr. Ruth is describing is what's going to happen when I finally pick my wife up on Michigan Avenue. She's going to get in the car and I'm going to shut the door. I suggest that she is not in any sort of reasonable apprehension of immediate or future bodily harm. At least I hope not. The fact is, if with that element, when you confine somebody and they are in reasonable apprehension of bodily harm, it isn't some let's go for a ride, honey, and get in the car situation where they are technically confined because I've locked the door and the power locks. So I think the fact that you are under just regular stalking, let's put it that way, following them, putting them under surveillance, and they have a reasonable apprehension of immediate or future bodily harm. And then when you add another element, which is you are actually confining or restraining them, I think you have exactly the kind of problem that was discussed in Wallace, Billups, and Kapler. Whether, even if that person thinks initially, oh, he's just shutting the door. And I think in Wallace, they went through all those scenarios. You could start that way. But as soon as this person realizes, wait a minute here, we're not going where we're supposed to go, the door's locked, I can't get out, now you have all the risks of fighting and jumping and so on and so forth that were described in that case. So I think clearly from that element, where there's a reasonable apprehension of immediate or future bodily harm, it implies non-consent. It is not an element like the Wisconsin statute, I realize that, but I think certainly like in as the court did in Kapler with the Illinois statute, non-consent is implicit in the fact that this person who is now confined or restrained for aggravated stalking is under apprehension of immediate or future bodily harm. And I think when you look at it that way, even if that constraining or confining is done initially in some nonviolent way, some polite way, some manner, the risk of violence and harm from at least the escape, when this person then in the next second realizes, wait a minute, I'm in danger here, then the game has changed. And I think in the usual way this is committed, not some hypothetical possibility, that means it's a violent felony and qualifies under 924. So, thank you for your time. Thank you.
Mr. Ruth?
Thank you.
Well, I actually agree with Mr. Vaudrey, except that he has the law wrong. If it was just reasonable apprehension of bodily harm, I think he'd be right. But the statute says reasonable apprehension of bodily harm, future or present, sexual assault, or confinement or restraint. So if there's reasonable apprehension of future confinement and restraint, or restraint, and then the person is confined, the statute is met. So it isn't just bodily harm. And that makes all the difference in the world. As far as page 2, Your Honor, of the that the government submitted without comment, without proving, without establishing that it was page 2 of the indictment, you are correct. The page that states 1 to 15 grams of a controlled substance is this page 2 that's just sort of floating out there, and nowhere on it or does it indicate that it's page 2 of anything. Or doesn't even, it has Mr. Mayherk's name, but we don't know the case or where it belongs or anything like that. So, thank you. I see my time is up.
Thank you, Ruth. Ms. Bodrow? Case is taken under advisement, and the court will proceed to the fifth case, United States versus Taylor.